With Robert Knight was brought to you on recording. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, after a fashion. My name is Jim Freund. A new time slot, a new show, old title. But with me, one of the best guests ever, Richard Bowes, will be with us. Stay tuned. Good morning. Okay, so first thing that you need to be aware of is that Earthwatch no longer goes until 2 a.m. And my program, which has been heard over these airwaves from 5 to 7 a.m. in various time slots over 38 years, last 20, a mere 20 of them are on Saturday mornings, is no longer on Saturday mornings. It is Wednesday night, Thursday mornings, from 1:30 until 3. And first of all, I mean, notwithstanding Robert losing half an hour of Earthwatch, I'm thrilled to be following him because not that it wasn't great to follow Habte Selassie. He does a wonderful show, he and Ian, and they are great people. And there was a surprising crossover in terms of people from Hobte's show who stay tuned in for Hour of the Wolf. But the show that Robert does, the concept of free form, his understanding of a lot of the topics that I try to cover and understand are really very simpatico. It's really cool to be following one freeform show, albeit it was recorded this morning, with another. And, you know, topics, they'll blend well. So I welcome you to this if you are one of Robert's many faithful listeners. And if you are one of my listeners and not tuning in, what can I say? It's like, come over here! Or if you have found me, thank you so much. A bit of background, Hour of the Wolf began on this station during the time that is called Hour of the Wolf. Hour of the Wolf, Vargtimen in the Swedish, is that time. I actually have the recording here from the Ingmar Bergman film, which is where Margot Adler got the title from when she started the show. It's the time when the ancient Romans and a lot of the Nords believed that people died, people were born, that dreams became real. It's a dark, in many ways, dark and nasty, nasty and wonderful time of day. It's a magical time. The time between night and dawn. There are people who think that it's like at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m., the middle of the night. Say again, Rick?
It depends.
It depends on
when the dawn is going to occur.
Oh, well, yes, absolutely. And when you're talking about, for example, the twilight, the Swedish twilight, which, you know,
it goes on forever.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's hours long. And that, in fact, if you watch the movie Hour of the Wolf, which is actually available freely online on Google Video and a couple of places legally. It's a fascinating film, actually, Max von Sydow and Lee Vullmann. What was I talking about?
Hour of the Wolf.
Oh, that was it, yes. Well, listeners of mine will get used to this. What I am not used to, of course, is the fact that I now will have half an hour less to my show as well, because Hour of the Wolf was a two-hour show. And it occurred in that time, always the dawn, whenever the dawn occurred, at least in New York, somewhere between 5 and 7 a.m., was Hour of the Wolf. So after 38 years of branding, of doing that program, even though I am in a time slot that is most certainly not that time of day and hour of the Wolf, as noted on our guest's Facebook page, does not refer to an hour. It refers to, well, what is it you said, Rick? It's a period of time.
It's a period of time.
It's a moment.
And it varies. One of the things,
like the hour of reckoning.
Well, one of the things in summer, at least, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, the night is very short, and thus the night is more packed with magic. I mean, Midsummer Night's Dream, that's the shortest night of the year, and there just isn't enough time to contain all the magic. In winter, the nights go on much longer, and that has...
And in Sweden, forever.
Well, Sweden, either there's no night or there's nothing but, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but a lot of it is twilight. The opening number in Act 2 of Little
Night
Music.
The endless twilight. Yeah,
exactly. So here we are. Basically, Hour of the Wolf was a general live radio show. And in the beginning, when it was 5 days a week, yes, this show was 5 days a week, 5 to 7 a.m. every morning on WBAI for, 8 or 9 years. And only one or two days a week would be dedicated to speculative fiction or science fiction or fantasy or whatever you want to call it, that stuff, the fantastic genres. And when I was left with some movements, some cancellations, various things, as WBAI changes, which it is in the process of doing again this very week, last week and this, during such changes, one day a week would be my science fiction morning. And I have kept that since, about 1979, and since I was moved to Saturdays ever since. Many people don't realize that Hour of the Wolf was not, in fact, primarily a science fiction show. But left with only one, and especially now left with 90 minutes, it's going to be a very different show in this time slot. I don't know what it's going to be. It will evolve. But through the years, I do know that one of the best guests, there have been several, a lot of best guests, several of whom are still alive. There's Barry Molesberg, who does an annual appearance, and lots of folk. But Rick Bowes has been a stalwart, a wonderful reader. There's nothing that you do on the air.
And I'm not dead.
And you're not dead.
I'm not dead. Not yet. And
no.
May happen tonight, but no.
So Rick Bowes, on his books, it says, and stories, it says Richard Bowes. And Richard Bowes has published 5 novels, 2 collections of short fiction, 50 short stories and articles. Recent and forthcoming stories appear in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction and the Digital Domains. That's an anthology, the digital.
It's an anthology of stories from the different online sites that Ellen Datlow edited. So it'd be Sci-Fiction, and then
Omni Magazine,
and then there was the
Event
one
Horizon,
Event Horizon,
which
thank
I worked
you.
On.
Thank you. I can never remember that one.
Yeah, it was a good one. It was way if it came out now, people would say a little ahead of its time.
No, it was. It was excellent. It was where I first read Jeff Ford.
Yeah.
So yes, it was.
So a collection called Digital Domains, Best Gay Stories, Beastly Bride, Wild with an E on the end, as an Oscar, obviously, stories. Is that a Steve Berman publication?
It is a Steve Berman production.
How did I guess? Haunted Legends, which is just out. Naked City, Nebula Awards Showcase 2011. I haven't seen that yet.
Well, it is in 2011.
So it's not out yet.
Yes.
Supernatural Noir and Blood and Other Cravings. He has won the World Fantasy Lambda, which is, what, best gay science fiction, basically?
Or? Right. Best.
Or gender-bending.
No, it's best gay. The Lambdas give out God knows how many awards. And that's the one for speculative fiction, basically.
Right. And then the International Horror Guild and the Million Writers Award. So, what I didn't find in your biography online anywhere, you have hardly any good biographies, even on your own website.
Well, there's so much I don't want to talk about.
We should name some of your books, like Minions of the Moon, from the files of the
Time Rangers,
which is not, by the way, as pulpy.
As it pulpy sounds. God knows I tried, but no, it turned out not to be. Well, I began, actually, the first 3 pieces of speculative fiction that I sold were novels. And first 3 pieces of fiction of any sort that I sold were novels, and I sold those. And it was War Child, Feral Cell, and Goblin Market. And I thought, no, there's really nothing to this. And then the paperback original market collapsed, and I began writing short stories, which I like much better.
Yeah, and as people who don't know are aware, I am a huge fan of the short story. Not that I don't like novels and even the long, long, long form, but short stories to me are these, you know, perfect little gems of polished work.
They can be.
When done properly. What I forgot to mention, by the way, is what will be coming up on this program in future weeks. And originally, next week, I was going to have N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, who is, well, just wonderful, and she is an up-and-coming writer of fantasy and a little bit of science fiction, I think, but mostly fantasy.
Yes, I read a short story by her, which the one that was in Clark World, the one that was a Nebula nominee. I would think on some level that's a science fiction.
Oh, yeah, actually, that definitely is.
Yeah.
The non-probability zero. It's a wonderful story. And but she's not going to be on next week because I went to see a play. Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said. Now, this is based on a novel by Philip K. Dick. There was a movie very, very loosely based on this novel called... Yeah, Rick is wiggling his hand, and I'm, as Matt Kressel, who is one of the biggest fans of that movie, knows, I'm not a fan of that movie.
And the movie is
Blade Runner.
Blade Runner, yes.
Yes, the movie is Blade Runner by Ridley Scott. This is a play by Edward Einhorn that is running off Broadway, and it actually is based on the novel. It is recognizable, very recognizable, as that novel. And not if you were to see, if you were familiar with the movie and were to see this play, you might think, oh, there are some things in common here. But
some themes.
Yeah.
Well, that's about all the movie shares with the book, actually, is some themes. There isn't really much.
Yeah. So and the names of characters. So next week, because the run, which is at the Untitled Theater number 61, if you care to look it up, and that would be untitledtheater.com, because that run ends December 11th, Nora was very gracious, and we will have the playwright and director of that. That's one person, Edward Einhorn, who has also written some fantasy. I mentioned to David Hartwell, who, of course, knew Philip K. Dick and published a lot of his stuff at the Science Fiction Writers of America soiree last Monday. And I said, this guy is here who you should meet. Author of this play. And I said, it's Edward Einhorn. And he said, isn't that the guy who wrote the Oz books? Some of the Oz books we published? And indeed it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So he will be here next week. And then Nora, N.K. Jemison, will be here the week after that. And the week after that, is in contention. A couple of people have to get back to me. But John Anderson will be here 1 week. And Laura Ann Gilman will be here 1 week. And Terrence Taylor and Rick Bowes, among other people, will be recurring guests. And while in the past, Barry Malzberg was always on in September, this being a new show, we'll have to have a new deal. We'll have to have him back because he's always a great guest. And lots of people. Altered Fluid, the writers group, will still be here. And I haven't spoken to Robert directly. I've only spoken through the program director. But my understanding is there will be occasions in which either we will co-host for 3 hours, or Robert will do 3 hours midnight to three, or I will do 3 hours midnight to three. So there will be flexibility and very interesting stuff that can be done in this time slot. Now that I have wasted a third of the show already. Good morning, Rick.
And you wondered how you were going to fit all of this in. Good
morning. I was, but a lot of that was necessary.
Yes.
It's my first show.
It is, well, first show here.
It's the first show in this slot. It really is a different show. I'm keeping the name because of the branding, but it's a different show.
Well, we will see what happens.
Yeah. So, yes, we will. But earlier on Hour of the Wolf, we had done all of the who are you and what have you done, and we just covered, you know, some of the novels and short stories. Now we have a choice. We can interview, chat for a bit, or if you want, we could go straight into your reading a story.
Well,
all bets are off in the way we used to do it.
Let me talk about what this is, I'm going to read part of a story that appeared in the March-April magazine of fantasy and science fiction this year, and it's called Waiting for the Phone to Ring. It's part of a story cycle that I'm turning into a book. My last couple of novels have been mosaic novels, as we call them, or fix-ups, as they used to be called.
Fix-ups if you're being rude. Mosaic novels if you're
treating this as, art, yes. And there are 15 stories in this cycle, and they've all been published. One of them was actually, I Needs Must Part, the Policeman Said, was the title I gave, and that was a steal from Philip K. Dick, but of course his title is a steal also. It was a steal from John Dowland,
Flow My Tears.
Right, song and lyrics, Flow My Tears.
Which was also, by the way, the Mabu Mines did a theatrical production of that. That was wonderful.
And Mayan was I Needs Must Part, the Policeman Said, and that, of course, was also a Dowland song. This one is another story in that cycle, and it contains a story within a story, which I will try to indicate. When we get to that, I'll talk in a funny voice. No, I'll indicate that that is what is happening. And shall I begin?
Why not?
Why not, indeed. On a morning last October, I was reminded of the Velvet Underground song New Age in the live version, the one where Lou Reed sings about getting a funny call today. My funny call came before 10 a.m., early by my standards. Since I've retired, I sleep late. Marty Simonson said hello and asked how I was. My friendship with Marty goes back to college. He's a stage director now. Got a Tony nomination a few years back for that play about Dorothy Parker. Marty has, of course, an instinct for the dramatic tease. An old friend of yours was talking about you last night, he told me. She's known you almost as long as I have. Then, a slight pause, while I tried to imagine what he was talking about, and he said, Judy Finch says hello. That was a surprise. It was long ago, and very briefly, that I'd thought of Judy Finch as a friend. We hadn't spoken since about the time she became the girl in the menage at the center of that legendary early 70s catastrophe, the band Lord of Light. I'd seen her since, of course, like anybody might, in the famous scene in the Scorsese film where she shoots De Niro, as Pirate Jenny when they did Threepenny Opera at Lincoln Center. And there was the period when she took the name Judy Icon, hipper than Madonna, more famous than Patti Smith. She did stage shows, collages of memory and songs, all improvisational, never done the same way twice. But it was in the East Village, in the late great 1960s, that I'd actually known Judy Finch. Her father was a well-known sculptor. Her mother was a critic. She was 19, studying theater and hanging around Max's Kansas City. My earliest memory of her is one afternoon when I was on a front stoop in the East Village with my close friend Joan Mata. This girl with long blonde hair walked by and said hello to Joan. Looking at Judy as we got introduced, I first saw a nice schoolgirl, then a tough city kid, then a young woman with a tinge of tragedy. She sat and talked with us for a while. When she left, Joan told me the legend of Judy Finch and Ray Light. A few years before, when Judy was 15, her boyfriend had been snatched off the street by private detectives who made a living returning runaways to the families that wanted to destroy them. They'd been apart ever since, but she loved him still. 45 years later, I asked Marty, what's she doing these days? And how the hell are you and she so intimate? She's writing, composing, doing what we all do later in life, trying to make it all make sense. She's got a stage work in mind, and on helping her shape it, we wondered if you were free for lunch today. This promised to be kind of interesting. Then Marty made it more so by adding, I told Judy about a piece you wrote a while back. You showed it to me just after Philip Marcy died, and that whole scene exploded. You know the one. Do you still have it? I told him I thought so. Could you bring it along? She was intrigued when I described it, and I think this may be material she can use. This was one of those mornings, maybe you have had them, when pressing dental bills meant that a couple of $1,000s would not have gone amiss. I agreed to meet them at noon at taxi stand over on the Bowery. It took a little searching, but the piece Marty had mentioned was in a storage box in my closet. Down among the scribbled rejection notes from long-forgotten editors, the abandoned projects, old notebooks full of catty commentary, aborted plays and novel ideas, sketches for board games I'd once designed, letters from old lovers, I found it. Typewritten on cheap yellow paper, it was an artifact from the early 1970s, with attitude and run-on sentences to spare. In part was personal memory, and in part an insight I'd gotten directly from the mind of Judy Finch's old flame, Ray Light. I sat on the stool in my kitchen, read the first couple of pages, and remembered how I'd taken my own experiences and woven them into Ray's insight about what had happened to him a year or two before it happened to me. The story is the kid with the sun in his eyes. The kid hasn't even been given that name yet, as he stands on the corner of East 4th Street in the Bowery and tries to blink away the late afternoon light because he's not used to it, because his eyes are a bit pinned. Just a couple of weeks before, the kid rode from Ohio to the city in several cars and a couple of trucks, always with lone drivers, guys who sometimes just wanted to talk about themselves and their families, and all he had to do was be there. Other times, along the way, things got done with his body, and for that he managed not to be present, to take a mental walk and come back to himself when everything was over, and he and the driver were once more rolling towards New York. That ability to go away was the thing about the kid, more even than his hair and his clothes, that his parents wanted to cut off him. In the city, the kid hit Times Square first, and it was bright and confusing and scary, and then some guy took him downtown to the East Village, which was poor and run down, but easier to figure out, and the cops were mean, but not so thick on the ground as uptown, and other runaways warned him about where not to go, and who in the neighborhood got rewards or kicks turning in underage kids like him. So the kid, 16 years old, stands on the corner, leaning on a brick wall, with one leg up behind him in classic pose, and this mad boy who's taken the name Rambeau is there with him, talking, making flowery gestures, saying, "Another place, another dimension or something, is where this stud thinks he's going, man, and he thought I was the one who was going to take him there, is what's so funny and freaky. Like he's a cult leader, but somehow he's trying to learn from me." The kid is coming to understand that it's drugs and hustling that keep boys like him and Rambeau alive and in contact with this world, and he feels still in control of all that. Because he has a kind of skill sometimes with a Mark or John to know what they know as they know it, and without them being able to tell he's hip to them. With all that, he finds himself this afternoon out on the block early because he slipped over some line and woke up just after noon with a very nasty need. Rambeau says, "The stud is important in art stuff. He owns a gallery or something. He told me he could get me a job and he wants to see me tonight, but, like, he's the most weirded out trick I've ever turned. One minute he's telling me to read his mind, the next he's ready to push me out a window and fly." When Rambeau's finished talking, the two of them pool their money to split a $5 bag of junk to hold themselves over until the night. Just as they're about to set out for East 7th Street where they'll score, Rambeau nudges the kid and says, "There he is." And the kid sees the outline of a figure, a guy crossing the street, silhouetted against the October sun, streaming down the long blocks. Then it was getting late, and I skimmed the rest of the story. Thinking about it as I brushed my teeth and showered, I understood both how it had never sold and how it would be of great interest to Judy if the project was what I suspected it was going to be. Walking east on Bleecker Street, stopping at a copy shop to get some clear reproductions of my favorite fading pages, I thought about Judy on stage at the Fillmore, singing with the group Lord of Light. The Fillmore East in 1971 was in the last months of its brief and glittery career. Rock groups were playing in sports arenas by then. The neighborhood was going very bad. Heading the bill that night was a frazzled hippie band whose last hit had been a year or two before. A canny old bluesman had second billing, with Lord of Light as the opening act. Little Judy Finch was Judy Light now. Her abducted boyfriend had returned, and Ray Light was his name. The Dark Lord crown was in the street, waiting to be picked up, and he was one of the contenders. Rumors of death and intricate kink washed around the band. But the Fillmore audience was tough. It took more than that to impress us. Joplin and Hendrix and Morrison had come and gone and left us with exaggerated memories of their performances here. Everyone in the group I was with was ripped out of his or her head. The Fillmore was maybe two-thirds full. Then the psychedelic amoebas of Joshua Light Show filled the back screen. The drummer and bassist laid down a beat. The group was on stage. Ray Light wore black from the neck on down. Judy had a blonde crew cut. The guy called BD wore long white robes. Our world was all afire with Lord of Light stories. Ray and Judy and BD were almost openly an offstage three-way. Didn't come across on stage. Ray and Judy came together to harmonize, then stepped apart. BD moved around through the stage like a zombie while banging a tambourine. Everyone in the East Village knew that BD had been one of the private cops who had helped abduct Ray 6 or 7 years before. Ray Light's father paid money to have his son forcibly brought home, then had the boy hospitalized and given shock treatment. It was said the doctor who treated Ray had killed himself while Ray was in that hospital. His father had committed suicide not long after Ray's release. "Revelation in 1,000 volts," Ray Light sang. "Blowing you to heaven," sang Judy. The essential thing with the cult legend, as opposed to a popular star, is that in an audience of 2,000 people, the star touches most of them, but the cult legend can touch maybe 100. In Ray's case, it may not have been that many, but the touch, I can testify, was searing. Those in the audience, who were like me, got caught in Ray Light's memory, passed with him through iron doors that were locked behind them, went down institutional hallways to a place where they were strapped to a table and had their brains blasted with electricity. Then the song was over. I glanced around. Saw an audience just mildly grooving, but I noticed a couple of others besides me who looked more than a little disturbed. After that, most of Lord of Light's set passed without anything similar happening, and I was about to write off what I'd felt as what happens when you spend many long nights doing many strange drugs. Then they sang Just a Boy Without Wings, a song where Ray Light yelled, "Reach me, reach me, reach me or die," and I was naked and handcuffed on a window ledge, trying not to look at the pavement 8 floors below, while trying desperately to meld my mind with that of the man who stood behind me. The nightmare lasted until the music stopped, and I was shaking and wet with sweat. I realized that Ray and I shared at least one very bad experience, and that he could do what the nightmare man had tried to force me to do. As the reverb from the stage died down, my friend Marty, who was sitting next to me, shrugged and said, "I give it a 9 because you can die to it." The rest of our party laughed, but I was still trying to get myself to breathe normally. That window ledge was a memory I'd taken some care to avoid. Still thinking about that long-ago night at the Fillmore, I found myself on the Bowery in front of Taxi Stand. Maybe you remember the restaurant. It was briefly trendy a few years back, just after it opened, up the street from CBGB's, which was still in business then. Completely remodeled in aluminum and glass, Taxi Stand occupied a spot that had been for decades a blousy all-night cafeteria, favored by cab drivers, cops, and prostitutes, both TV and female. Wall murals of black and white photographs from the 40s and 50s caught the Bowery by night, neon signs, parties from uptown slumming, drunks with ruined faces singing, fat women flashing their garters as they danced on bars, drunken college louts trying to be hip. When I arrived, right at noon, the place was almost empty. I saw Marty before he saw me and was amazed that a white-haired old guy like that was still off on artistic adventures. He's 63, a year and a half younger than I am. When Marty spotted my approach, he said something to the woman with him. Judy Finch turned my way, smiled, spoke my name. She looked good, mid-40s instead of late 50s. Ash blonde, no obvious work on her face. For an instant, I saw a flash, the honey-haired kid caught between boarding school and Max's Kansas City. She stared at me, and I wondered if she was remembering that first encounter or was just trying to remember me. "I can't believe it," she said softly, saving her voice. "We precious few don't die easily." She took a sip of the mimosa with which she was bringing the morning to a close. "Marty tells me you've got some amazing material." He had ordered iced tea, which meant that he was keeping his head clear. I did the same, and Marty told me about the show they were developing. "Be a little bit like Cabaret, a bit like those evenings Elaine Stritch did in B. Arthur. Great monster ladies of the American stage, talk about breaking onto Broadway, sing a couple of Sondheim songs, reminisce about Golden Girls on TV, then give you a few funny, painful glimpses of their lives." "Their stage careers are kind of impressive," said Judy. "But I pretty much got those old ladies beat when it comes to the life story aspect. Living with the Lord of Light, who turned out to be the God of Death, and the guy who killed him, they can't top that." She laughed at my startled expression and said, "Oh, yes, I'm going to talk about Ray and BD and the deaths. We're going to use a bunch of Ray Light songs that Judy did originally," Marty told me. "There's a band in the show." "Yes, Ray's music has slipped out of people's memories," Judy said. "This maybe will bring it back. What she can't get is permission to use any kind of reference to Philip Marcy. Nothing he wrote, not a photo, nothing," Marty said. "His family threatens to sue if his name is even used. They were afraid we were going to defile his memory, as if that would be possible," said Judy. "We were kind of stuck. Then Marty asked if I remembered you, like I ever forget anybody from back in the East Village. Just the way she looked into my eyes and said that made it pretty certain that she had forgotten me. The waiter came with my drink and took our orders." "Can you show us what you have?" Marty asked. I brought out a copy of The Kid with the Sun in His Eyes, read aloud the opening section. I'd looked over at home. I finished, and Judy said very quietly, "When I was 15, I used to walk Ray down to 4th Street every night. He called the guy he lived with the man. I never saw the man. All I knew was I hated him. Then she asked me, 'You have more?' The waiter came with our food. I put the oyster poor boy I'd ordered aside and read. At night, East 4th Street becomes an off-Broadway Rialto, and the kid mixes with boys and girls at the corner of 2nd Avenue. The glassy-eyed drag queens smoking in the alley next to the Club 82, where guys in dresses talk dirty and sing lewd songs in falsetto for the benefit of middle-aged drunks in New York City on business. Kid slips in and out of the intermission crowds at the Truck and Warehouse and La Mama, pokes his head into Phoebe's on the corner of the Bowery, looking for a daddy for the night. And there, in the smoke, and amid the crowd of dealers and at-liberty actors and lead-poisoned painters and playwrights dying for a break, a guy comes to him and says, 'The kid with the sun in his eyes.' For a moment, the kid is in the man's memory, a thing that every once in a while happens with him. Sees himself on the street that afternoon with Mad Rambeau, who has since disappeared, and knows this is the guy Rambeau was talking about. The guy starts buying him drinks, tells him his name, says he has a gallery uptown, and even seems like he thinks the kid might be impressed. But the only thing about this John that the kid pays attention to are the money laid out on the bar and something he says. 'You can read me. I felt you do it. I see you flying towards the rising sun with your eyes wide open and blind, and I'm tagging along.' The kid understands what Rambeau was saying about this being one crazy queen, but he believes he can handle it. Later, with the crowd beginning to thin out, the man says he knows the kid is the one who's going to break through, and he wants to find out tonight. By then, the kid snorted enough junk in the men's room, using the man's money, that he's plucked off the bar, and he isn't afraid of anything. The kid with the sun in his eyes can't remember the drinks and the junk, can't remember the ride in the creaking freight elevator, or what happened to all his clothes, or when his hands got cuffed behind his back. 'Close your eyes and see into me,' says a voice behind him. The kid's bare feet are on a windowsill. A huge window is open in front of him, and 8 floors below is the concrete sidewalk. The glimpse he briefly had into the mind of the one who brought him here is wavy and blurred. Reaching it now is like trying to see through a sun glare, even though it's night outside, and cold air is biting him. "Look at me," he hears the man who stands behind him say. But the man has a grip of iron and holds the kid's head so the kid can't turn to see him. "Look into me," the man said. "You did it once this afternoon when I first saw you. You did it for a moment in the bar, and you will do it again. You will look into me," he said. "I can teach you how, but I want you to be able to do it better than I can. Once I had this boy, I found him on the street and brought him here, and he could see with his eyes shut, could look into me, but not at will, only off and on. I taught him in the same way I'm teaching you, and when he had almost reached the point where he could lead me, they took him away." He talks some more, and the kid realizes he's going to be trapped here and tortured until he sees or he dies. The man held the kid's fingers to a lighted candle and told him, "I'm teaching you as the one who taught me did. He brought me to the point where I could meld with certain other minds, and I can do that with you. He would have taught me more, but he was taken from me. I will not leave you until you can go into every mind and meld with everyone." At first, the man never let the kid with the sun in his eyes out of his sight, kept him tethered and tied when he went out, got him off drugs cold turkey. The kid could not just go away in his mind with the man. The man could go there and bring him back. The kid stopped fighting it because he was learning to get inside other people's minds, and most of the time with most people. But he could at least look down at the street below, look inside certain people, and he wanted to learn how to do that with everyone. After the first night, the man no longer suspended him in front of an open window or forced him to communicate. After a couple of weeks, the man trusted him enough that when he went off to work one morning, he gave the kid a dollar, let him out on the street, and told him to come back at 6 o'clock. It was a test, and it worked. The kid was fascinated enough that he did come back, even though he hated the man. Given how things were, there was no hiding that. The night that I had seen Lord of Light at the Fillmore, I went back to the place I was staying. In the paper was a story about an art expert, Philip Marcy, jumping out a window. I sat down at an ancient Underwood typewriter and wrote, "The Kid with the Sun in His Eyes," and 40 years later, I was still kind of pleased with it.
Hear the sledges with the bells, silver bells. What a world of merriment their melody foretells. How they tinkle, tinkle, tinkle in the icy air of night. All the heavens seem to twinkle with a crystalline delight. Keeping time, time, time with a sort of runic rhyme. From the tintinnabulation that so musically wells. From the bells, 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 bells. From the jingling and the tinkling of the bells. Hear the mellow wedding bells, golden bells. What a world of happiness their harmony foretells. Through the balmy air of night, how they ring out their delight. Through the dances and the yells and the rapture that impels. How it swells, how it dwells on the future, how it tells. From the swinging and the ringing of the molten golden bells. Of the bells, 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 bells. Of the rhyming and the chiming of the bells. Hear the loud alarum bells, brazen bells. What a tale of terror now their turbulency tells. Much too horrified to speak, well they can only shriek. For all the years to know how the danger ebbs and flows. Leaping higher, higher, higher with a desperate desire. In a clamorous appealing to the mercy of the fire. With the bells, 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 bells. With a clamor and the clanging of the bells. Hear the tolling of the bells, iron bells. What a world of solemn thought their monody compels. For all the sound that floats from the rust within our throats, and the people sit and groan in their muffled monotone. And the tolling, tolling, tolling fills a glory in the rolling from the throbbing and the sobbing of the melancholy bells. Of the bells, 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 of the moaning and the groaning of the bells. Hear the sledges with the bells, silver bells. What a world of merry men their melody foretells. How they tinkle, tinkle, tinkle in the icy air of night. All the heavens seem to twinkle with a crystalline delight. Keep in time, time, time with a sort of runic rhyme from the tintinnabulation that so musically wells. From the bells, 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 from the jingling and the tinkling of the bells.
Ah, that went a little too fast. Still, I'm using a different machine. This is, as you can tell from the tight segues and all that, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf, about version 3.0 or 4.0 going through the years, but the first time that Hour of the Wolf is not during the time of day that is classically Hour of the Wolf. I will be here for the foreseeable future from 1:30 to 3 a.m. on Wednesday night / Thursday mornings, depending on whether you're lying down or standing up. And with me this morning is Richard Bowes, Rick Bowes, whose story you just heard a version of.
A part of,
yeah. Yeah, a part of. And I've heard other parts of that same story. I'm familiar with the characters. I never heard it quite the way that you just read it. But I'm familiar with the characters.
Well, actually, there is there are two YouTube clips of me reading this story at World Fantasy.
That's a convention.
Yeah, that's a convention. Yes, it is a convention. And you think I made slips reading it tonight. You should have heard that. That was really, really dreadful.
Who filmed that?
Scott Edelman.
Edelman. Yeah, he's been doing a nice job. Yeah. I have to talk to him because he films wonderful things, and I can help him make the audio better on his film clips. But a few people are starting to do that and put readings on. I, of course, also, by the way, should mention, I run the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series. And I film those, although I haven't done anything with the films yet. I certainly record them, and people who listen to this show will hear some of those. Also, I attend and record the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series.
What do you do with those recordings?
I play them.
You do?
I do. I play them on the air often. And I archive them at some point. We'll figure out how to get them all online or something like that. Certainly Matt Kressel, who is co-host with Ellen Datlow of that series, knows how to do this stuff.
He knows how to do everything.
Well, maybe so. we might get him on the air next week as well with Edward Einhorn, because he is such a very, very, very studied on the movie Blade Runner. I think that's a good way to put it.
You know, I saw Blade Runner 3 times in theaters. I saw it during its initial run, we had the theater to ourselves. And then I saw it. It came back again, mm-hmm. and was an event, and it was well attended. And then there was the director's cut, and they practically had the mounted police out to you know, control the crowd. I'm not sure the movie changed all that much, even with the director's cut, but definitely its place in the speculative fiction universe changed enormously.
It is visually amazing, but in terms of story, I have issues.
It does have a lot of problems.
Yeah. And I should mention, by the way, that obviously, a lot of the movie Blade Runner is an homage to Metropolis, visually speaking.
Right.
There's no question about that.
No.
And I'm sure Ridley Scott here, he would say, well, of course. And I mention that to point out that a new version of Metropolis has just been released on DVD. And this is the restoration that the Murnau Foundation
right.
did about 7 years ago with an additional 20 minutes that was found in, I think it was Argentina.
Somewhere
Brazil.
In South America.
Somewhere in South America where, you know, one doesn't have to think very hard. How did German movies find their way there after World War II?
I don't know. Those German movies, do you think that the last thing that Eichmann did, you know, when he left Germany, was saying, I got to take my print of Metropolis with me?
I mean, Goebbels wanted to make Fritz Lang the head of the Reich Films. It was on, he went and visited Lang one afternoon, and that evening is when Lang left for Paris.
Right. Scared the living daylights out of Lang.
So he was certainly admired by the Third Reich.
Yes.
Which means that they weren't paying attention to
right,
the message.
At
the
any
movie.
Attention at all, no.
Yeah. Do you want to open up?
Why not?
If you would like to speak with Rick Bowes about science fiction, fantasy, the stuff that he writes and the stuff that we do. The telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And for those who are unfamiliar with my methodology, freeform, footloose, and fancy-free I may be, but I do ask for relevance to the guest and to the program itself when people call up. So be well aware of that. We're on till 3 a.m., so I guess we have half an hour. We'll take calls on and off here
and there.
If
anyone is willing to call us.
Yeah, indeed. Hard to tell. This is an all-new place for me. Actually, not true. I mean, I go way back, and I was on midnight to 5 a.m. once a week.
Well, do you suppose that man who called at the beginning of whenever the phones were opened up on your prior show.
Do you mean Bob Rodriguez or Monroe Lippman?
I meant the Debbie the Dominatrix.
Oh, him! I wonder if he's going to find me.
Yeah.
I mean, he missed my final show, even though we took phone calls. But
his heart must have been broken.
We were getting a lot of calls coming in, Margot Adler and I together, and couldn't take them all. Couldn't take them all. But that was a fun show. Did you hear any of that?
Just a bit. Yeah.
It was fun. Tears were shed, and I almost shorted out the console here.
You almost electrocuted yourself.
Indeed.
Yes,
indeed. But the and then the second part where we fell into what was and is again Simon Lokely's time slot. Margot did her vampire thing. Which is to say, Margot Adler, for those who are attentive listeners to her on National Public Radio, may be aware of the fact that Margot has read 125 vampire books in a row. And if you can imagine that. And she gives you can go to archive.wbai.org and list, or to my website, actually, howerwolf.com, HOURWOLF. And click on link. That would be part two. And you will hear her explanation of how this came about and why she's been doing this oh-my-God thing.
Well, it is kind of strange. But on the other hand, she's the granddaughter of a psychiatrist. So
mm-hmm.
it's almost
One of the psychiatrists.
Right, one of the,
Franz had to Adler. Alfred Adler. But her father was Kurt Adler, who was...
Also a psychiatrist.
Oh, absolutely. He was my uncle's shrink, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Yes, he was.
And did your uncle get cured of his problems?
No, I don't know. When he was my age, he'd been dead for 7 years.
Well, that, you know...
He smoked Lucky's.
Did he? Well, yeah. Good luck to him.
Yes, and that alone might explain a lot.
So what he needed wasn't a psychiatrist. What he needed was a general practitioner.
Something along those lines, indeed. So I can't say, but my uncle did do two things for my life. He introduced me to WBAI and thought maybe I should volunteer to answer phones. That was in 1967. And he introduced me to reading Theodore Sturgeon and Ray Bradbury when I was about 07. So quite...
Yeah, that's
quite
a horrible burden for him to...
Yeah.
What did he do? Nothing.
Basically.
Nothing.
He was, during World War II, he was...
A deserter.
OSS.
Oh, he was in the OSS.
And after World War II, he was, shipping films.
Good, yes. When you're a little kid, the relatives who are unemployed or in the rackets or something like that,
yeah,
they're always around in the afternoon to take you to ball games. They're the ones you really like.
Yeah, exactly. So let's take a call. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. Gee, that was a marvelous story. Fascinating. Are you from Boston, Richard?
I definitely am from Boston.
Ah,
yes.
Ah, good.
And I was once on a list along with Howard Waldrop and a few other people of people in the genre who had retained their charming regional accents decades after they had left the region. And yeah, I can't kick it.
I didn't quite get the point at where it turned into the story within the story. Did I miss something?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have changed my voice.
You had
I should
said
have done.
You were going through that
he
story.
Did, as a matter of fact. He did say, and now this is. So listen to it again on the archive and you'll catch it.
I can't do that. Oh, one more question. Hello?
Yeah. Hello. We're still
there. About the name Adler.
Yes.
Now, I owe a big tribute to Alfred, the psychiatrist, for delving into birth order within the human family. I'm wondering if there was any relation between the psychiatric Adler and the theatrical Adlers.
No.
None at all?
None at all.
Too bad, but there wasn't. No.
Yeah. Although there are those people who would like a connection between her and Irene Adler, but she Irene Adler is fictional.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. To Sherlock Holmes, she would always be the woman.
Yes. Yep.
212-209-2900. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Monroe. Good
morning. Hey, listen, that was George Eicher, who just called.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
I'm familiar with his voice, but not the name or anything.
Huh?
I'm familiar with his voice, but not the name.
Yeah, well, I just want to identify him because he's still going strong. I unfortunately doesn't have a computer. And the real problem is the cost of the internet, to have that is an additional thing,
It is. Anyway, it's about $15 a month. Yeah.
Well, it's a little more.
No, it isn't. You can do it for $15 a month.
Well, maybe you can, but I'm Verizon, so it's a...
That is through Verizon. I'm a professional at this.
So I should get it cheaper?
Yes. Well, yeah, you get slower, but you get it cheaper.
Probably, yes.
It's not dial-up. It is broadband.
Here's my problem. I'm very concerned about the survival of WBAI.
As are we all, but that is not relevant to this program.
Excuse me. I was going to mention about Ralph Nader that I'm recommending.
Yeah,
that,
you keep doing that, and it's still not relevant to this program.
In regard to the subject of vampires...
Which was relevant to my last program.
Yes, I know. Well, is that wrong to bring it up?
Well, briefly.
I have to ask a question.
That was for Adler.
My ignorance.
What is it?
Well, my ignorance is I have that impression of I want to suck your blood. And the point is that is that what vampire movies are about? The fact that
no, now they've become about high school dating patterns.
Yes, I know. Well,
yeah,
well,
nowadays vampires.
We take the metaphor. We're taking the metaphor in the vampire instead of the physicality. There is a Alan Dadlow and Terry Windling are bringing out a anthology called Teeth, in which it will all be YA vampire stories.
YA being young adult.
Young adult vampire stories. And I've read several of the stories in the book, the writer's show.
Are you in the book?
No, I'm not. I was having dental work done when she was doing that. The last thing I wanted was a book called Teeth. But nowhere in the stories I've read is there blood-sucking. It's emotional vampirism. It's vampirism by other names. You know, Twilight, the vampire aspect of it, at least as far as I got into the book.
OMG, Rick.
Is like not... That isn't where it's at this point. We're on to another level of vampirism.
And there will be a forthcoming book all about the current trend and mythology and the zeitgeist that is vampires. And it's written by somebody named Margot Adler, and I recommend it.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is, what is the word vampire used for? I mean, bedbugs suck your blood. And I just can't fathom.
Well, there are many answers to
this
question, but
we're in the realm of metaphor.
It's fantasy. It's not science fiction. It's supernatural horror.
Well, what's horrible about high school dating patterns?
Okay,
remember high school?
No, but I mean that's just it. I mean
Well, that's where it started, and it has moved on. It has become its own entity and a major cultural zeitgeist. So if you're asking, you know, where did vampires start, well, I would recommend, you know, probably Wikipedia if you have it, a bona fide encyclopedia. There are libraries with books in them and stuff like that. Outside of that, what it has become, well, we'll find out who is going to buy Margot's book. She's got 4 bids currently, and then she'll write it, and then we'll all read it. And in the meantime, you can go to the WBAI archives, archive.wbai.org, and you'll find As I Please, actually, from a week and a half ago, or whenever.
Some period.
And a lot of the questions on that are answered there. And thank you for calling. The telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And good morning. You're on the air. Yellow.
Hi there. Yeah. Jim?
Yes.
First thing is, I don't think you need to suffer fools so much calling. I think it's okay to hang up on them. That's the Tom Whisker theory.
Tom has a very different style than I have. I like Tom's show, though.
Right. By the way, your weekend, I'm only going to be able to listen to you on archive now. It's going to be really hard to listen and to call in. You and your guest mentioned Ellen, and that reminded me of a question I'd like to put to your guest. And,
Rick Bowes.
I know. But,
okay, well, you say your guest, you're talking to him directly, so.
Well, yeah, and you know who I am. But your
no, I don't.
Oh, well, you should. Your mention of Ellen reminds me of something that Catherine Pendle has brought up to me many times at work, and I'd like to ask your guest this specifically. And I'm asking him and not you, so zip it for, I know it's tough. But
fine, just say Rick. You don't say, you're talking to both of us.
What is it that you want to ask?
Which is, you guys were dumping on Blade Runner, and I wonder what kind of liberties do you think it's okay when you switch from the text medium to some other...
Well,
emotion.
Any...
I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks.
No, that's all right. Any kind of liberty...
He doesn't
liberty,
suffer hosts easily either.
Any kind of liberty that you want to take is all right if it works. I didn't think... The problem I had with Blade Runner was that the Harrison Ford character just was the dead...
Had nothing to do with anything. Deckard.
Well, it doesn't... That didn't bother me.
Okay.
I didn't care about that. I don't care about Philip K. Dick's plots, and I don't care about Philip K. Dick's characters particularly, since they're all Philip K. Dick.
Yeah,
some
they are.
It just, he wasn't compelling. There were too many, at least in the original format of the movie, there's nothing there. There's no backstory for him. Later, you know, when it can be hinted that he is himself an android, there is something more. But it was just, you know, there was this person in the middle of the movie. The movie is about him, and he's not about anything. And I think that that was a big part of the movie's problem as a commercial venture.
Yeah, the Rick Deckard of the play, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, is very different from the one in the novel. But it has a very significant character. I think he's sort of a Philip Marlowe.
Yeah, I think that that is partially what Dick was trying to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, that he, you know.
A lot of Dick is reminds me of a lot of Chandler, actually.
More than Dashiell Hammett. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, yeah. More than. Although Chandler thought he was writing the great American novel, and Dick thought he was a hack.
Although I guess Dick had wanted to write the great American novel.
Later. And earlier. Right. Earlier. Yeah. Earlier he did. But right. When he started writing science fiction, it was because they'd buy it.
Damn straight. That was it, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. It wasn't because he had a
not
compelling...
Not like the rest of us who buy it, who write it for high artistic reasons.
Well, you could be writing other stuff, Rick, but you choose.
I don't think
to write.
I could, actually. Mm. It becomes a habit, you know. Resolution, you know, becomes so much easier.
Yeah, I think that you write what you write, and it comes out as speculative fiction. But I think that's where it takes you.
Well, the thing that about it is that everyone says that it's autobiography, so it's like...
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of your characters are Rick Bowes, and a lot of your protagonists.
Well, in the latest stories, when some, you know, he's the narrator is referred to as Rick, so yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's not even thinly disguised.
Not even
thinly disguised.
No,
that's pretty overt.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to speak to the overt Rick Bowes, telephone number is 212-209-2900. And for those who are interested in discussion, debate, thought about Philip K. Dick and theater and movie, tune in next week when my guest will be writer and director Edward Einhorn, whose off-Broadway show, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, shares the same source novel as the movie Blade Runner. My guest the week after that will be Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison. She's just wonderful. So tune in then. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Yeah, listen, I...
Very brief, Monroe. You've had your time.
What?
You've had your time. Be brief.
Well, I was offended by that caller.
Okay, you know what? You two call each other.
No.
Don't talk to me about it.
On WBAI.
Marriage counseling is not what we're doing here.
Specialist, it's for the open of the mind.
Okay, well, there is truth to that, and you know what? I actually side with what you have to say more than with what he had to say, but I'm also not going to give it a whole lot of airtime, so I'm moving on. Because that's not what this program is about. The two of you, get your own show, okay? And then you can hang up on me. If you'd like to talk to Rick Bowes, however, yeah, maybe I should adopt the Tom Whisker.
Well, you know, this certainly is the WBAI I remember.
Careful, I was drinking water there. And again, you know, last show I almost cried on the console. This time I almost spit on it.
Well, you know, I mean, this is...
This is the WBAI.
This
you
is
remember.
The WBAI of my childhood, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Well, okay.
My adolescence, anyway.
More like, because we're now as constituted like this in our 51st year.
Yep.
Just a little over 50 years old. Okay, let's see if this is somebody besides Monroe. Good morning, you're on the air.
Jim, freedom of speech
does not exist on this radio program, because as long as I've got the hang-up button.
Right. Freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is reserved for those who have a microphone.
Exactly, it is, and the idea of producing a radio show and being a talk show host can, and in my case, does mean that I carry the direction of the conversation. And if it's not of interest to you, then you're not going to be on the show. It's that simple, and it's got nothing to do with freedom of speech. This is not a freedom of speech radio program. Okay, this is a program about speculative fiction, which has many different definitions, but it is not what one listener said to the other listener, and about the other listener, and all that. If you would like to talk, and you being somebody besides Monroe Littman, would like to call, and now I'm going to get blasted on the blue board, which I never go to.
What's the blue board?
The blue board is a BBS. It's an old-style computer bulletin board service kind of thing on the Internet in which basically everybody moans, groans, bitches about WBAI. They do nothing but that. I went there. The last time I was there was well over 5 years ago. Although there is somebody there who has been accused of being me. It's not me. I don't go there. I don't write there. And when I do write, it's generally under my own name. Either J. Freund, Jim Freund is one word, Jim.Freund, depends on what login I am using. But when I type, with the slight exception of certain things that have nothing, that are only about software and software things. In those cases, I'm occasionally anonymous. I'm going to wait. There's a call coming in. I'm going to wait until we have two or three calls coming in. It's a lot safer that way because then you can dump one and go to the next. But
that was like a blast from the past.
Well, it was. It was. And Monroe has been calling for that many years. I certainly remember him from the 70s. And he can occasionally, by the way, be utterly fascinating. He can occasionally be so on target and so focused on the correct thing, which is why I do give him the chance to be relevant. But when he's not, well, then I don't answer the phone anymore. 212-209-2900. And we have about, 15 minutes left. Not used to this time slot for many reasons. I'm not sure this time slot ever existed in the history of WBAI. 1:30 to 3.
Now you're breaking new ground here.
Yeah. There's been 1 to 3. There's been 3 to 5. There's midnight to 3, midnight to 2.
I've never heard of a 1:30 to 3 o'clock.
It's a new thing, which actually means that Robert Knight has lost half an hour, and they've inserted me in there. It's sort of a compromise. I thought at one point of calling this Hour of the Wolf the Lemonade Edition. You know, and people, if you want to figure that out, it means, well, you know,
making the best of a bad situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Which is why, and you know, the program director is trying things, yes. And yes. Some of them are good, and some of them not. But the idea is, you know, if we all stay on camera, maybe we can save the barn.
Is that the way you think of the station?
Well, I think of the attempts to save it sometimes as being Judy and Mickey. Yes, so. So it can be that. Okay, let's see if this is somebody else. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, Jim, you don't come to LSB meetings either.
No, that's right. I don't. I studiously avoid them, and I'm avoiding your calls now. You're now persona non gratis on at least for this morning. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Oh, isn't it nice to hear some other voice and a woman's voice at that?
I've been a long-time listener of BAI, and unfortunately I haven't heard Hour of the Wolf in a long time, and I actually like your new time. I just wish it was 2 hours.
Yeah, so do I, and so does Robert, no doubt, wish that he was on for 2 hours.
Well, Robert, I think you'd love to know that I, for a moment, I had you confused with Richard Bowes, but you're obviously two different people.
No, I'm Richard Bowes.
Oh, you are Richard Bowes. Well,
yes.
I am the happy possessor of your early novels, War Child, Feral Cell, and Goblin Market. And I also love your newer work, the Time Rangers and Minions of the Moon. And I was wondering what your next project is going to be.
We are so glad you asked.
Yes, that is such a nice thing to ask. It's another mosaic novel. It's 15 stories, all of which have now been published. And it's called Dust Devil, My Life in Speculative Fiction. And at this point, I'm turning all of these stories into chapters. And
Most of these stories have been published.
All.
Ah, okay.
All of the stories, all 15 of the stories have been published at this point. The first one was There's a Hole in the City, which was about 9/11. And the first one I consciously realized was, you know, I had something.
Which has been, by the way, been broadcast on WBAI three times on 9/11 so far.
Well, I didn't know they were still doing that.
Yes.
Well, it's...
Wasn't that one first published in FNSF?
No, that was in Sci-Fiction. It was published online.
Oh, okay.
And it's been in a few anthologies. It was in that's the one that's in Digital Domains, in fact.
It's been a much published story because it's one of Rick's best.
Despite everything, yeah. One of the things about it that was so strange, I wrote it in 2005, so it was, you know, 3 years after the event. Everybody began writing about it about 9/11 at that point. It was like it took a certain amount of being away from the subject to be able to write about it. But that was the first, and some of the stories have done very well. There's one, If Angels Fight, that won the World Fantasy Award the year before last, and this year, I Needs Must Part, the policeman said, was on the short list for the Nebula and the World Fantasy Award, but unfortunately I was robbed and other things won instead. But it's an honor just to be nominated.
Wow, that's great. I can't wait because obviously I'm going to want to get it.
Why, thank you so much.
And now you've heard a preview, actually, of a piece from the book.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, this is part of a story that was in FNSF in the, I have to keep looking here to remind myself, in the March-April issue of this year. Five of the stories appeared in there, and a bunch of them appeared in various anthologies and elsewhere, all over the place.
That's great, because I wouldn't have been able to track down all of them. I've read the ones in FNSF because I subscribe, so that's great. But I'll certainly have not read some of the other ones.
Some of the other ones, yeah. Well, that's the thing about anthologies. Sometimes the anthology becomes something that's on everybody's mind, and then other perfectly good anthologies just slip completely by.
Well, it was just so great talking to you. And you do you live in New York?
Do I ever. I live on McDougal Street.
No, I live in Chelsea, a native lifelong New Yorker.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't think there was anyone who was born in New York.
Excuse me, I am.
Oh, I'm sorry, two.
Yes,
two people born in
New York. We outnumber Boston here, yes.
No, I was born in Queens.
Well, I'm from Jackson Heights originally.
So you're not from New York.
Okay, we're going to have words after the show.
Well, I'm going to enjoy the new time slot.
Okay, well, thank you. I think I will, too.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay,
thank
have
you.
A great morning.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
An uplifting call. At least it lifted me up. Now we've got a whole bunch of calls. Good morning. You're on the radio.
I was born in Manhattan.
Okay. So now that's three against one. Good morning. You're on the air.
How do you spell Bowes?
B B-O-W-E-S.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good question.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, because there are people who would think like the headphones, B-O-S-E or
it still
B-O-W-S.
It still shocks me when I'm, you know, doing something and there's Bose speakers. And I said Bose speakers.
Yeah, right, exactly. I know. That always perks me up and go, oh, right. Good morning. You're on the air. Hi, we're on delay, so pay no attention to your radio.
Okay, well, I just turned it off so I wouldn't get too thrown off. I'm another nice lady from Chelsea.
Oh, cool.
I was listening. I love having somebody read to me. It was a very nice thing. I had a bunch of things I had to do, and it was just perfect.
One of the features of this show, wherever it goes, will be a reading every week, or a radio drama if it's not a reading.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Yeah, I was. I have a granddaughter whose birthday is going to be celebrated tomorrow at Thanksgiving, and what I do with my grandkids is I give them $50 in $1 bills, and I go over to Staples and I get little labels, and then I put them 50, 49, 48, etc. So in a big stack, you know, I put the numbers up in the corner of each dollar. And then, you know, if they take $13 off, they can see how many are still left and all that kind of stuff. But with the older grandkids, it's a big drag because they have to just keep peeling those things off while they go off to buy more expensive things. But for the little ones, it's nice because then, you know, for their little street fairs or whatever they go to, you know, it's sort of nice.
You should consider dollar coins. I love dollar coins.
Yeah, I like dollar coins too. But I got one bunch of grandkids. I gave dollar coins to, and then when I came back, they were all over the floor.
Oh dear!
I was like, come on, honey. You know, I guess they just look too much like toys or something.
Yeah.
But in any case, I was busy writing my numbers and listening to the story, but I was expecting more of a, you should pardon the expression, science fiction or fantasy thing to come out of it, you know, and that just sounded like what I remember of those days, you know, it sounded very realistic.
Well,
I mean, unless you're sort of thinking about that the guy could get to see through people or whatever. But
well, it is about telepathy, and I don't really think there is such a thing as telepathy. So in that way,
oh, I think so. Yes. You can count that as science fiction.
If you believe in telepathy, then it is, you know, complete naturalism. But if you don't, then in fact it's speculative fiction.
I see. Okay. All right.
And when you put it all together into the form that the Mosaic novel will become.
Uh-huh.
Self-Moses,
huh?
There you go.
Moses, yes, he invented
Moses
the Mosaic novel. Yes, yes.
Right.
No, there's all kinds of stuff. There are ghosts. There's, oh, God, people.
Oh,
okay. Oh, you'll love it.
So it's when taken as a whole that the speculative fiction aspect, which in the case of Rick's work is often a better term, even from the files of the
from
time
the
rangers.
Files of the time rangers. Yes.
There, I got it right that time.
You did, yes.
Even that qualifies more as what people call speculative fiction than outright, you know, rocket whizzing science fiction. But we're going to have that on the show too.
Like Ray Bradbury, you mean that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Where it'll be just regular, and then they'll suddenly be a little
yes,
spot with everything, you know, there's this black hole kind of spinning in the middle of the whole thing or whatever.
Right, or
yeah.
Mars turns out to be very much like the Midwest, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that is very Bradbury.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to like to read that, too. I didn't get to Pynchon until recently, actually,
mm-hmm.
When you were talking about reading them as a child. Wow. But,
and Pynchon, yes. You know, one could argue that Pynchon is science fiction. You know, Gravity's Rainbow, page one, Sun Goes Nova, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't see, since I'm just reading it recently, I just read his latest one, the detective one.
Ah, yes, I am planning on reading that.
It's nice. I was reading it to somebody who had kind of met him He had lived on Venice Beach. Well, he had lived on Venice Beach, so when I say kind of met him, he said, oh, yeah, I think I knew that guy. So it wasn't, that's to me, kind of met him, because they both were there at the same time.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so I was reading him all that, and he's like, you know, with all the things that I'd read.
Well, I've got 2 minutes left until I have to put the outro music on.
Oh, okay. All right, so get somebody else then.
Okay, well, actually, it'll just be the two of us, I think. But thank you so much for calling.
A pleasure, and welcome to this piece of time.
Thank you so much.
I hope it turns out to be very good for you.
I hope so, too. I have hopes for it.
Right.
Take care. Good morning.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, okay, so a couple of nice calls to finish out. A couple of nice women from Chelsea there.
That's right. And I knew there had to be somebody.
Yeah. Well, yes, indeed. They're not all Monroe, which is very Philip K. Dick, where everybody turns into Palmer Eldritch or John Malkovich or something like that. So let us recap a couple of things. Number one, because I'm probably not going to outro during the music. This has been a new version of Hour of the Wolf. It will continue to be on Wednesday night, Thursday mornings from 1:30 till 3 a.m. My guest next week will be playwright and novelist and director Edward Einhorn, whose show Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is currently running off Broadway. My guest this morning is Richard Bowes, B-O-W-E-S. Thank you for asking.
That's right.
And, 30 seconds left. So what do you recommend people read first, buy first? Go to your website?
Go to the website. It's rickbowes.com. And there are various of my stories, from recent stories that will be part of Dust Devil and stories from earlier in my career, including a couple of fairy tales that I read in The Bear Dresses Secret and The Cinnamon Cavalier are there, and which are very silly stories, and I'm really very fond of them. But yeah, take a look. You'll see there are pictures of me and stories.
Okay, and for my part, there is a website due for overhaul at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, and feel free to visit. You can send email to me at jim@ourwolf.com. And thank you all for listening to this inaugural program of a new series. Thank you, Rick, for being the first guest. It was
my pleasure.
And mine. Thank you all for listening. Be back next week. Take care.
Brilliant show from Jim right here at WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, your favorite radio station. Yeah, Jim, welcome to our listeners' No God Zone. I'm such a big fan of Jim's. We're going to have to fight over Mark Jacobson. It's 3 o'clock. New time for Burn Baby Burn, y'all. Until 5 o'clock or until 6 o'clock. Baba Bacon, y'all.
Could we really win?
Clock right here at 99 Cinco WBAI. Yo. At exactly 3 minutes after three.
Flies through the ring, don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances
away. Rock your feet and dance. Crowd of people full of enjoyment. Rock your feet and dance. Happy will not be good for bringing out the place. Rock your feet and dance.
Mr. K performs his tricks with Alan. a sound. And Mr. H will demonstrate in Somerset he'll undertake on solid ground. Having been some days in preparation, a splendid time is guaranteed for all. And tonight Mr. Kite is topping the bill.
When we come, we don't run. All of them I do, all of them I try, but them can't survive. Come and bless by the most high.
Exactly 11 minutes all after the hour right here. 3 to 5, Burn Baby Burn. New time on a Thursday right but after Jim Freud. Yeah.
Why?
After Selassie so jealous that we got Jim before. Burn Baby Burn. 99 single list alive.
Come give me the realness.
6 o'clock a brand new wake up call just the for you.
Dangerous systems.
Yeah, misgiving day y'all. Burn Baby Burn. Both
come make we chant on the killing. Cause when we come in a girl me a defend. Yes, me a defend, I may not apprehend. Try to open up, let go and venture. Not defend a love with a hidden agenda. For soul takes time, so never surrender. Only you can defend.
Just joining us, this is the No God Zone, where we don't force you to bow and pray to no dogmatic fascist called Selassie the First with no apology. That's why we call the show Burn Baby Burn. Yeah. 212-209-2900, we're gonna fly the telephones in the spirit of Jim Freund. Yeah!
All of them are doing, all of them are trying, but them can't stop high, blessed by the most high. Time to open up, let go, stop doubting. Time to keep a focus. Beware of the bogus, for hate is a tool and passed by the fool. For love will conquer, stand up on a rule. Know your roots and the truths and rights will come. Never give up, don't run. Hana na 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 sweet flex.
exactly 20 minutes after the hour, 20 minutes after 3 o'clock, Cox and Jackson, Studio 17. That was Randy Studios downtown, Beeston Street, Brentford Road, Cox and Jackson. You're listening to Studio One, Big Difference. Yeah. 20 minutes after the hour, right here. 212-209-2900. Get it off your chest. We're flying the telephones right here. And then anything can happen. For example, roll men are the biggest fatty fatty. Hydroponic. Non-medical. Sensalania. Do it, y'all. Do it. Do it. So we do it. Do it. Strictly new music right here at 99 Cinco Lista Live, WBAI. 24 Wheeler, your turn to burn. So we do it, yeah. My brethren, last night I drive from Stony Road in Roney Brook with about 18 spliff on the dashboard. I'm saying, Lista, I'm for bonus before me reach.
Stay away from the war and crime. Get to you, the crazy King Selassie. Yes, stay away from the war and cry. In that this at the market, you to come and start to shine. Hear my people when I say, Jarastafari rules and way. Put your gun for kill your brother. Remember Rastafari loving Jordan. Good over evil, Selassie ruler. Upon the chonja is the master. Shall go man you name Selassie is the conqueror. Rastafari, Rastafari, yeah. Stay away from the war and crime. War and crime. Get for you to praise King Selassie. Oh yes. Stay away from the war and crime. Stay the in that this at the market to children. Youth at truth and right. Ghetto youth to stop the fuss and the fight. Ghetto youth to need Rastafari light. Afi burn hypocrite, afi burn parasite. No stand up the way of the foolish man. Oh yes.
This is a no God zone. The youths of Karachi, Ramallah, and them place there. You know, yo. Must can do better than that. Musk can do better than that. We don't buy that. This is a militant career at the end of the tunnel where we don't force you to bow down and pray to no Selassie the first. Stupidness now. Face reality. Smell the weed. And come around, y'all. Listen.
Stay away from the war and crime.
Straight up fascist. Straight up fascist.
From the Babylon crime.
Ain't no reggae show going to point that out to you. Because there are a bunch of cowards behind Lister's marijuana smoke glasses, y'all. And Lister's sense of mania microphone, y'all. Straight up, yeah. The fascist. Straight up, y'all. Fascist straight up. Rubber dub time. Wet
yes,
up time.
Tighter,
baby. Tighter. 24 minutes after the hour, right here. 24 minutes after Patra time. Patra time. Burn, baby, burn time. Produce me, Lista. Produce me.
Attention, center of attraction. Sir, Mr. Mention, what's the position? Tell me your story, I'll tell you my version. You are American, I'm a Jamaican. Me, I go show you where the right sex come from. Say this a portion, is a love portion. But right now, I want you to give me some action. Where I want it, on top of the ocean.
Tell me that you want me.
Tonight.
I can tell the way you touch me.
Yes, come touch me now.
night.
Yes, every morning. Let me tell you something,
I can see you grinding, baby. You can't stop moving my leg.
Oh, gosh.
Because I'm right behind you.
Now the mood I make with S-E-X. I hear you drooling, but I am rolling. Tonight is the night, no time to fool. Coming at the queen patch, just school for some teaching. Some muggling and some bubbling. Romancing, you're hypnotizing. Coffee, you're loving, boy, full of the timing.
Tell me what you want me.
Center of attraction, yeah. Send Mr. Mention, what's the position?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me your story, I'll tell you my version. You are American, I'm a Jamaican.
Yes,
me, I go show you where the right sex come from. Say this a sex come from down a Westmoreland. And this a girl, she not afraid of no human. And if you're bad come, give me the action.
Tell me what you want me.
What's up? Tick-tock, tick-tock, bird, baby bird.
This is Patch and Aaron Hall.
Never know that.
And we know what it is to me.
I know that.
The right music, okay?
I know that.
What's up?
Used to hang with Aini Kamosi, Patra back in the days. Aini Kamosi gave her her first start right here at 99.5 WBAI. Speaking about WBAI, the first radio station, rather station to play this year tune, yeah? When it was rough mix style. Now this is the Lista mix, the Maoist mix, yeah?
Plans, it's true. Curly locks.
Coming on strong.